There's a man I think you've heard of. His name was Martin Luther King. Well, he wanted a world of peace and love. He said, I have a dream.
This is Murray Everson, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In honor of Martin Luther King Jr. Day, I'm going to be reading a couple of articles about Martin Luther King. Part one is The Dream. In quotes, I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed that all men are created equal. That was given on August 28th of 1963 when they had a march on Washington for jobs and freedom. To the article, The Architect of the 21st Century. With one phrase, King joined Jefferson and Lincoln in shaping modern America. This written by John Meacham. It was not going well, or at least not as well as Martin Luther King Jr. had hoped. The afternoon had been long. The crowds massed before the Lincoln Memorial were ready for some rhetorical adrenaline, some true poetry. King's task was to lift his speech from the ordinary to the historic, from the mundane to the sacred. He was enjoying the greatest audience of his life. Yet with the television networks broadcasting live and President Kennedy watching from the White House, King was struggling with a text that had been drafted by too many hands late the previous night at the Willard Hotel. One sentence he was about to deliver was particularly awkward. And so today, let us go back to our communities as members of the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Dissatisfaction. King was on the verge of letting the hours pass him by. Then, as on Easter morning at the tomb of the crucified Jesus, there was the sound of a woman's voice. King had already begun to extemporize when Mahala Jackson spoke up. "Tell him about the dream, Martin," said Jackson, who was standing nearby. King left his text altogether at this point, a departure that put him on a path to speaking words of American scripture, words as essential to the nation's destiny in their way as those of Abraham Lincoln, before whose memorial King stood, and those of Thomas Jefferson, whose monument lay to the preacher's right toward the Potomac. The moments of ensuing oratory lifted King above the tumult of history and made him a figure of history, a new founding father in that apt phrase of the historian Taylor Branch. "I say to you today, my friends," this in quotes, "even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream," King said. "It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream, a dream that had been best captured in the promise of words written in a distant summer in Philadelphia by Jefferson. I have a dream," King continued, "that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Drawing on the Bible and my country, 'tis of thee, on the Emancipation Proclamation and the Constitution," King, like Jefferson and Lincoln before him, projected an ideal vision of an exceptional nation. In King's imagined country, hope triumphed over the fear that life is only about what Thomas Hobbes called the war of all against all rather than equal justice for all. In doing so, King defined the best of the nation as surely as Jefferson did in Philadelphia in 1776 or Lincoln did at Gettysburg in 1863. "I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a desert state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skins, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today," he spoke. 55 years on, no matter where one stands on the political spectrum, it's all too easy to be glib about the meaning of the March on Washington and the movement's victories. The 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. For some conservatives, the civil rights movement belongs to a kind of antiquity. In striking down a key section of the 1965 voting rights legislation, a bill consistently renewed by Congress, including as recently as 2006 for an additional 25 years, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that our country has changed and that the discriminatory world where African Americans were blocked from the ballot box no longer exists. On the other extreme, there are liberals who believe that racial progress has been so glacial, never mind gradual, that the shootings of young men like Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, and Philando Castile, and the subsequent acquittals of their killers, are all too often the rule rather than the exception in America. The prevailing reality and a crucial legacy of King's speech to the nation may have been best captured in the summer of 2013. In the wake of the Martin verdict, when a particular African-American calmly enumerated the daily acts of racism that still shape our national life. In quotes, there are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me, and there are very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often. And yet, the black man making these observations in the James S. Brady press briefing room at the White House was the 44th President of the United States, Barack Obama, who was a toddler when Martin Luther King Jr. stepped up to the podium in March of 1963. The most obvious observation about life since August 1963 is also the most accurate. We have traveled far, but not far enough. Revisiting King's speech, the religiously infused culture from which it sprang, and the political moment in which he delivered it suggest that he, for one, would not be especially surprised by the ambivalent state of affairs in the America of 2013. Like our more familiar founders, Washington, Adams, Hamilton, Jefferson, he was a practical idealist, a man who could articulate an ideal but knew that human progress, while sometimes intoxicatingly rapid, tends to be a provisional enterprise. The march, he said that day in Washington, was not an end. It was not but a beginning. We live in a world where King helped create that. We do not yet live in the world he helped all of us dream of. It is tempting to romanticize the words King spoke before the Lincoln Memorial. To do so, however, cheapens the courage of the known and the unknown nonviolent soldiers of freedom who faced and often paid the ultimate price for daring America to live up to the implications of the Declaration of Independence and become a country in which liberty was innate and universal, not particular to station, creed, or color. The true honor we can give to King and his comrades is not to render them as fanatical figures in a maniacal struggle, but to see them as human beings who summoned the will to make the rest of us be the people we ought to be. The death of Jim Crow was an epic journey, but it is no fairy tale. For the half century since the March on Washington has surely taught us that although African Americans are largely living happier lives, no one can sensibly say that everyone is living happily ever after. The dream of which King spoke was less a dream to bring about on this side of paradise than a prophetic vision to be approximated, for King's understanding of equality and brotherhood was much likelier to be realized in the kingdom of God than in any mortal realm. In Washington, to demand legislative action, King spoke as a minister of the Lord, invoking the meaning of the Sermon on the Mount in a city more often interested in the mechanics of the Senate. However unreachable King's dream seems to be on this side of paradise, though, we must try. Like the promises of the Declaration of Independence or the Gettysburg Address or FDR's first inaugural, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. The promises of King's I Have a Dream sermon can be kept only if the nation is mindful of what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature. In his words to the March on Washington, Martin Luther King Jr. gave us a standard against we could forever measure ourselves and our nation. So long as his dream proves elusive, our nation remains imperfect. While Washington had expected mayhem, few bureaucrats or lawyers who worked downtown in the Capitol showed up for work on Wednesday, August 28, 1963. That many blacks in one place? Who knew what might happen? Even the ordinarily liberal New York Times was wary. There was great fear there would be rioting, recalled the Times' Russell Baker, who was assigned a front-page feature on the march, so the Times chartered a chopper. Boarding the helicopter early in the day, Baker grew so bored by the peaceable spectacle that he asked the pilot to fly over his house so he could check on the condition of his roof. Finally, said Baker, I had him land at National Airport and went to the Lincoln Memorial. It was, it turned out, not only orderly, but also integrated. Baker wrote of Bob Dylan, Charleston Heston, and Marlon Brando. The paper took note of the series of speeches and songs, including Jackson's I've Been Buked and I've Been Scorned, a spiritual delivered with such power that Baker reported Jackson's voice seemed to echo off the far-off Capitol. Speaker after speaker, the young John Lewis, the aged A. Philip Randolph, made the case for racial justice. For many, the day seemed an adventure, a long outing in the late summer sun, part liberation from home, part Sunday school picnic, part political convention, and part fish fry. James Reston wrote in his place for the Times that day. Watching King's speech into the White House, Kennedy listened with appreciation and then readied for a meeting with the march's leadership to discuss the practical steps ahead to push legislation through a Congress still dominated by white segregationist Democrats. The ensuing session did not produce much in the way of progress. Kennedy feared moving too fast, and as they had said again and again all afternoon, the civil rights delegation from the mall believed the time for action was at hand. Yet King, who craved forward motion, had spoken of delay and of dreams deferred. The pilgrimage would be long, he told his listeners, and the pilgrims had to maintain the moral high ground they had so effectively claimed through nonviolence. And that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the worn threshold which leads into the Palace of Justice, King had told the crowd. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. If the politicians were too slow, well, that meant there had to be yet more dignity and yet more discipline. The Times Reston, a reliable barometer of establishment opinion, however, believed the day had in fact accomplished something, even if JFK was less enthusiastic late that afternoon. The demonstration impressed political Washington because it combined a number of things no politician can ignore, wrote Reston. It had the force of numbers, it had the melodies of both the church and the theater, and it was able to invoke the principles of the Founding Fathers to rebuke the inequalities and hypocrisies of modern American life. Kennedy had not met with King and his comrades alone on the afternoon of August 28th. In the president's party was his generally unhappy vice president, Lyndon Johnson. It's a tragic irony of American history that a people enslaved by white men finally became equal before the law, not because of the nonviolent courage of millions of people of color, but because of the murder of a single white man. The horror of the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama on September 15, 1963, an attack executed by Klansmen, that killed four young girls loomed large in the national consciousness, particularly when the violence of the crime was contrasted with the nonviolence of the March on Washington. Yet there is no escaping the fact that the moral case King made before the nation in August 1963 was given legislative force only after the assassination of Kennedy in Dallas 3 months later elevated Johnson to the presidency. The passage of the landmark bills of 1964 and 1965 was possible because LBJ was determined, but a determined realist. Even if we pass this bill, the battle will not be over, he said after Selma in March 1965 as he proposed voting rights legislation. It would, though, be a battle won. From the Brown School desegregation decisions in 1954 and 1955 through the Great Society bills of the mid-1960s, Jim Crow was fatally wounded, so much so that the phrase is now anachronistic. Long-term research cited by Stanford's Gavin Wright shows that educational integration in the South has produced positive economic results for African Americans, including increases in graduation rates, test scores, earnings, and adult health status, while reducing the probability of incarceration. That's the good news. One generation removed from civil rights movement, we went from a country where a majority of the people believe in racial hierarchy, believed in the idea that there was one type of person who was fully deserving of citizenship, to a country where a majority of people reject that idea, says Cheryl Cashin, a Georgetown law professor and former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. Because of the civil rights movement, we became a country where a majority of people really embraced the idea of equality as an American ideal. It's seen as un-American to be discriminatory or racist. That's a major achievement, despite the fact we still have inequality. The National Urban League used the mark of 50 years since the march to measure the state of Black America. The organization noted that the high school completion gap had closed by 57 points. The number of African Americans in college had tripled, and there were 5 college graduates in 2013 for everyone in 1963. When it comes to standards of living, the percentage of African Americans living in poverty fell 23 points. The figure for Black children was 22%, and home ownership among Blacks increased 14%. Then there are the all-too-familiar failures. In the past 50 years, the Urban League reported in 2013, the Black-white income gap only closed by 7 points, now at 60%. The unemployment rate gap only closed by 6 points, now at 52%. Only at 100% will the gap have disappeared. Overall, the unemployment ratio was changed since 1963 at about 2-to-1 regardless of education, gender, region of the country, or income level. The Urban League also reported a distressing lack of progress since its 2013 report. The income gap between Blacks and whites remains at 60% as of 2013, while the Black rate of unemployment is still about twice that of whites. Those numbers, as well as enduring inequalities in the criminal justice system and the most recent Supreme Court ruling on voting rights, suggest that neither the march nor the movement is really done. The end of Jim Crow did not mark the beginning of what John Lewis, since 1987, a congressman from Atlanta, calls the beloved community of philosophical idea of a world that transcends racial, ethnic, economic, and gender barriers and is suffused by love. Citizenship and equality are broader conceptions than civil rights alone, says Daryl Miller, a professor at Duke Law School. The civil rights movement was about ending segregation, but also about being able to enjoy the fruits of being an equal citizen in all aspects of life, both public and private. On that August Wednesday, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, the spot on which he stood is marked there now, a sacred slab hidden in plain sight in the middle of the capital of the most powerful nation the world has ever known. King drew from Scripture as he joined the ranks of the founders. In the beginning of the Republic, men dreamed big, but failed to include everyone in that dream, limiting liberty largely to white men. Speaking in 1963, King brilliantly argued for the expansion of the founders' vision, nothing more, but surely nothing less. In doing so, a preacher from the South summoned a nation to justice and won his place in the American pantheon. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and every mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. He paused and then pressed on. This is our hope. This is the faith that I will go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. Transforming that hope into history remains the work at hand. Let's take a look at the chronology of the life of Martin Luther King, its life and its legacy by Courtney Mifsud. January 15, 1929, Michael Luther King Jr. is born at 501 Auburn Avenue in Atlanta. In 1934, his father, Michael Luther King, changes both their first names to Martin to honor Martin Luther. In September of 1944, Martin Luther King Jr. enters Morehouse College in Atlanta at age 15. In the fall of 1947, King Jr. delivers his first sermon in Atlanta's Ebenezer Baptist Church. May 17, 1954, ruling in Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, the Supreme Court declares that public school segregation is unconstitutional. December 1, 1955, Rosa Parks, 42, was arrested in Montgomery, Alabama, after refusing to give up her seat on the bus to a white passenger. January 30th, 1956, King's Montgomery home is bombed as he speaks at the First Baptist Church. He later addresses an angry crowd outside his home, urging nonviolence. January 10th and 11th, 1957, King is named chairman of the newly formed Southern Christian Leadership Conference, a group of black ministers sharing insights on ending segregation. September 25, 1957, federal troops enforce the integration of public schools in Little Rock, Arkansas, and escort 9 black students into Little Rock Central High School. On May 6, 1960, President Eisenhower signs the Civil Rights Act of 1960, reinforcing voter protections and introducing penalties for voter obstruction. October 19, 1960, King is arrested for breaking Georgia's trespassing laws due to a lunch hour counter sit-in in Atlanta. On April 12th through the 16th, 1963, King is arrested in Birmingham, Alabama, during a sit-in and writes letter from a Birmingham jail on the pace of civil rights justice. On August 28, 1963, King delivers his I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. On October 14, 1964, King is awarded the Nobel Peace Prize at the ceremony in Oslo, Norway. In December, he pledges the $54,000 award to the civil rights movement. February 21, 1965, Malcolm X, a Muslim African-American civil rights leader, is assassinated in New York. March 7, 1965, on Bloody Sunday, voting rights marchers are beaten and tear-gassed at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. March 25, 1965, King and 25,000 demonstrators march from Selma to Montgomery. On August 30th, 1967, Thurgood Marshall becomes the first black U.S. Supreme Court justice. On April 3rd, 1968, King delivers his last speech, I've been to the mountaintop at Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee. April 4th, 1968, King is shot and killed on the balcony outside his room at the Memphis Lorraine Motel. April 11th, 1968, President Johnson signs the Civil Rights Act of 1968 prohibiting housing discrimination. March 10th, 1969, James Earl Ray is sentenced to 99 years in prison after pleading guilty to King's murder. April 20th, 1971, the Supreme Court upholds busing as a means to desegregate public schools. April 29th, 1992, the acquittal of four police officers in the videotaped beating of black taxi driver Rodney King sparks race riots in Los Angeles. 2013, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi champion the hashtag Black Lives Matter movement. In September of 2014, the Justice Department opens an investigation into the August 9th shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed black teenager, by a white officer in Ferguson, Missouri. The officer was cleared in 2015. On September 1st of 2016, San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick kneels during the final preseason game to protest police violence against people of color. And August 12th, 2017, Heather Heyer, 32, is killed and 19 people wounded when a man linked to white supremacists runs a car through a crowd of counter-protesters at a far-right Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. And that concludes this reading of the Chronicle of Its Life and Legacy, including many of the facts about Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement in general, as well as part one of the I Have a Dream speech that King gave at the Washington Memorial in 1963. This is Murray Everson, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
There's a man I think you've heard of. His name was Martin Luther King. Well, he wanted a world of